The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 2nd of July, 2020. On the podcast today, Clive Beattie, acting CEO of On The Market at OTMP, and Clive talks through the increase in agent contract take-up and the record amount of leads generated from the portal. Also on the podcast, Tony Sirichik, CEO of Salt Lake Potash, SO4 is the ticker there, and Tony discusses how they received commitments to raise $15 million Australian dollars via corporate and institutional investors. Plus, Neil Rickett, CEO of Vesarion VRS, talks about the $5 million Innovate UK loan and provides a corporate update regarding their Chinese agreement. Plus, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covers news from the following companies: Associated British Foods, DS Smith, and Mitchells and Butler. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. You can see those on the front page there at voxmarkets.co.uk. In fact, there's top 10 visions of those lists where you'll see a lot more content. And you can also check out our COVID-19 index. At the moment, top riser on that index is Amiga Diagnostics, ODX ticker, up 6.88%. And the biggest faller is Biotrol, down 4.85%, 6.3 pence. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Are you tired of missing news about stock market companies you follow? The Vox Markets app helps investors stay ahead by making sure you never miss an important update. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Clive Beattie, Acting Chief Executive Officer of On The Market. That's OTMP. Clive, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Justin. Good morning.
Yeah, some good news out. Contract take-up and record leads. And we'll dig into what that means and how significant that is. Before we do, Clive, as always, if people haven't heard of you, and I don't know where they're living if they haven't, but just give us a brief summary of what On The Market is, please.
Yes, of course. It's a property portal. So what happens is agents and new homes builders will list the properties they've got for sale on our portal. And obviously, we then advertise those to seek buyers who are interested, who can see the properties on the portal and get in contact with the agent or house builder to pursue a purchase.
Yeah. And you like this because I have the apps on the market. And I have Rightmove as well. And I'm always looking at properties. I like looking at properties, but I had a property sent to me from On The Market on Tuesday, and that was 7:40 in the evening. Sorry, 5:40 in the evening, and then 25 hours, 38 minutes later, Rightmove sent me the exact same property. So you guys are ahead of the pack there.
Well, that sounds interesting because that's probably one of what we call our new and exclusive properties. And here, because we are significantly agent-owned, 65% still of our shareholder base are agents, a number of our agents do something called new and exclusive for us, which is where when they get a new instruction for a property, they'll load it onto us before they load it onto either Rightmove or Zoopla.
Yeah.
And it has to be at least 24 hours in advance to qualify as a new and exclusive. And that sounds exactly like that. So we're getting thousands of properties every month, at least 24 hours or more before the other two.
Yeah, well, that's a heck of a USP, because that's what it's all about. I mean, I just check every now and again, and I find no new properties on the apps, and it's that new one all the time that could be the one you're looking for, you know? So it's the fastest person to go and see it or make an offer, and that's it, isn't it? If you've got, 24 hours to look at it before other people, then it's a heck of an advantage.
No, I absolutely agree. You know, for buyers or people looking to rent properties, you know, to get in early is very important. And, you know, people don't do these transactions often. You know, you want to see what's there and you want to be first in the queue if it's the one for you. So absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, the news out today, so contract take-up and record leads. Let's start with contract take-up. Take us through this, if you could, Clive.
Yes, this is, we launched a couple of new offers under contracts that we launched during the COVID crisis, actually, at the end of April. And really, these were offers to try and grow further our agent shareholder base. So at the time, we had over 3,000 agents with over 6,000 branches who were the shareholders that hold the 65% I talked about. And really, we want to see that increase because we have a very close affinity with agents. And we think the fact that there is such strong agent ownership and support for On The Market is a key differentiator in the portal's landscape. So these offers were to encourage those who weren't yet shareholders in the business to join us. The way we do that is to give them some welcome shares and give them some shares based on the money they spend on the portal. But in return, they commit to a full tariff, longer term contract, a minimum of a year, so that, you know, we wouldn't give these shares just to agents on some of our free or discounted rates. But I think it's a very good sign because, you know, even during the COVID crisis, people saw our differentiation, saw our agent ownership, saw our commitment to fair listing fees into the future. And we welcome them on board. And, you know, it's a big increase on the numbers we had. And we want to continue to see that increase.
Yeah. And so what is it, what are the figures? What's the numbers here?
Well, there's around just under 500 new contracts under these contracts. But as I say, all branches under contracts. As I say, we already had just over 6,000 or around 6,000 anyway. So that's a 10% increase there. And obviously, we're still looking to sign new people on these contracts. You know, ideally, we'd still get, you know, many more as shareholders. We've got on the portal now, we've got about 12,500 agent branches. That's out of a market that's probably about 18,500. Although, to be fair, even the largest portal has, you know, under 16,000. So, you know, not all those 18,500 are on any one portal.
Yeah. So that's interesting there. Yeah, so you say 12,500, there's 18,000 agents out there, and even, well, the biggest one, which I assume is Rightmove, has around 16,000. So you're not far off that.
No, and, you know, I think the important thing is, you know, there isn't a portal at the moment that is whole of market. So, you know, actually, if I was a buyer, I'd want to be looking at least two, maybe three portals at the moment. I certainly want to be seeing the properties early, like our new and exclusive, just to make sure I was seeing what was out there.
Yeah. And as an agent, of course, I mean, you know, right, with more expensive, but having shares and having a more reasonable tariff, I mean, that's bound to make them more loyal to on the market. And do you find, I mean, is there a locking for the shares? Generally, do agents tend to hold, I assume they're long-term holders, aren't they, the shares?
Well, they are long-term. I mean, there are lock-ins associated with the share offers. But actually, what we've seen is that even the shares that some of them have staged releases. And certainly, it isn't the case that agents, as soon as they're able to sell, rush to the door by any means. You know, the majority of the shares that are unlocked have still not been sold. And hence why our shareholder base has stayed consistently around the 65-70% level for agents. You know, they haven't rushed for the door at all. And, you know, I think they've all seen that a successful portal is actually a very good business and can generate, you know, a lot of value. You know, the difference for us is we have thousands of agent holders, all with relatively small holdings, but nevertheless could be quite valuable for, you know, for the individuals and the people concerned. But, you know, they've seen in the past in the other portals two or three or four of the biggest agency groups make a lot of money. So they know that's perfectly possible. So I think the shares are, you know, definitely have a financial interest for them. But fundamentally, I think the reason they support us is because we're offering fair pricing, fair fees for the listing for their everyday business.
So, you know, supply is there. So what about demand? You've got record leads here. What's happening?
Well, actually, you know, the leads, as I say, very strong for us. We haven't actually been marketing, and this is one of the great things I think that's shown that we've actually made real progress in the last year or so, you know, from an operational perspective, because we've grown the content, be it, you know, the agency branches listing on us and the new homes developments listing on us, that is obviously much more attractive to consumers. You know, you combine that with the new and exclusive and the USP, we're getting, you know, lots of traffic and lots of leads generated for our agent customers. And yes, as you say, record leads. So we did over 1.8 million leads in June, an average of 134 per advertiser, which we think is extremely competitive and at our tariff, extremely good value. But it just shows, you know, for our agent customers, actually now they do have a portal that is working, that has consumer traction and interest and can generate them the business they need.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. 1.8 million leads generated in a month. An average of 134 leads per advertiser. That sounds, exactly. That's working, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when we set out on this, and we will admit, we, you know, a year or two ago, we were much lower than this, and that's why we came to market and raised the money, because we needed to boost the scale of the portal. But I think we've done that. But, you know, when we came to market, we thought that actually, you know, some of the competitive figures out there at the time were about 90 leads per month, and you know, we thought that would be good value. So these numbers are excellent, I think.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, Clive, as always, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of the progress you're making here but are not yet following the story, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add On the Market to their watch list, please?
Absolutely. Well, the first, I think, has to be that operational performance that we're now delivering that we just touched on. The scale of the advertisers we have on site combined with the return we're giving them, the number of viewers looking at the properties on our site and generating leads. So the operational strength, I think, is first. The second will be the differentiation of us versus the other portals, and that comes through our agent ownership and the fact that, you know, we do have all these agents both already supporting us and continuing to join us. And that will really differentiate us. You know, why wouldn't they support their own portal? And then third, really, I think it's I think, as people know, of our 12,500 or so agent branches, we still have a few thousand on discounted rates and a few thousand on free, which we, outside of the COVID crisis, would be converting to full tariff. And there's a huge revenue opportunity in the short term once that process can restart again.
Excellent stuff. Clive, good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Lovely. Thanks, Justin. Have a great day.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Tony Sirichik, Chief Executive Officer of Salt Lake Potash. SO4 is the ticker there. Tony, thanks for joining me.
Hello, Justin. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, listen, well, you released some news today, and I think some people sort of went, what? It was convertible note placement, and I think some people were expecting something else there, but so we'll explain that. But as always, Tony, I hate to leave people behind, so just get people up to speed who are not familiar with the company. Can you just summarise quickly what Salt Lake is all about, please?
Yeah, look, Justin, Salt Lake Potash is an Australian and AIM listed company, a mining company that is in construction to build its first sulfate of potash SOP mine in the goldfields of Western Australia. We have a portfolio in very close regional proximity. We have nine mine sites in that portfolio. So we have a very good scalability potential ahead of us once we get this first lake into operation. We're well into construction on Lake Way at that project, and we expect to be commissioning at the end of this year and only 8 months away from first production.
Yeah. Now, I know most people following the story probably thought the final, you know, part to this puzzle was the debt funding, and that was, I assume most people thought that was the next bit of news here, but then we get this convertible note placement. So can you explain what this is about, please, Tony?
Sure can, Justin. Look, you know, we are pulling together a very, very strong final financing or funding arrangement here. And we've got several commercial banks in the syndicate, and that's just taking us time as they go through their credit committees and get that signed off. So that's basically what's playing out now. The project is roaring ahead, moving at a speed that I love. And we've just, you know, with strong support from an existing institution, a new institution has come in. And then we've also seen a strategic investor stump up $10 million Aussie dollars. That's from Equatorial. So that interest was sort of shown to us early this week, and we decided to put that into play. And that basically de-risks the next few weeks and just allows us to put that final funding package to bed, you know, in a way that, you know, we're very happy with.
Yeah, yeah. So debt funding is going okay, but it's just taking a bit longer. And what, do you know why that's taking longer?
Yeah, look, it's several institutions that are syndicating on a common facility agreement. You know, we've got two that are credit approved fully. A third is going to their credit committee Monday next week, and the fourth is Wednesday next week to credit committee. So, yeah, that's just different institutions moving at different speeds, yeah. You know, different due diligence questions coming from committee members, that sort of thing. We've answered hundreds and hundreds of, if not thousands, of due diligence questions. Mm. It's been a lot of fun. But, you know, this convertible, as it's being called, is really deferred equity. You know, that's how it's well and transparently displayed in the notice. But, you know, this is $15 million Aussie dollars that ultimately comes off that final funding equity gap anyway. So it's now that equity gap less $15 million Aussie dollars that will be closing out sort of, you know, sometime within weeks, in the next few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And what people are saying, hang on a second, I thought you've just raised money. Why do you need this now?
Well, we're burning the rocket boosters at Lake Way. We've got a schedule that we've committed to. Ears are pinned back, pedals to the metal. Do not want anything interfering with that. And, you know, we have very, very supportive investors that believe in that that vision, that aspiration, the way that we work, myself and the team. And, you know, it speaks spades in the fact that just now another insto has come in on this this deferred equity or convertible that we've just raised. So our register now is probably speaks for about 10, you know, very large institutions. So a very robust and supportive register.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, and just for people not familiar with what you're hoping to produce, just take us through, if you could, some of the figures from your first project. And of course, that, like you said, you got nine lakes there, but the first one, just explain, you know, the background of that.
So I'll start with sulfate of potash. It supplies potassium, you know, with the chemical element K into the fertilizer market. So NPK, we will be speaking for the K side of that equation. Look, this first project, Lake Way, is 245,000 tons a year of sulfate of potash. You know, it's a premium product without any chloride in it. So very, very valuable to crops and end users that use fertilizer. This first project has an NPV of $479 million Aussie dollars, has a post-tax IRR of 28%, and a nice, comfortable payback just over 3 years. So, and as you said, you know, that this is the first project. The vision is that we will be doing multiple projects over the next 5 years and really walk ourselves up to creating an SOP province. I jokingly call it, I'm recreating the Pilbara of potash in this goldfields region here as we build multiple projects as the SOP market can take it over the next few years.
Yeah, so it's you're aiming for a big project here, you know, multiple, but in one, a big old company, yeah?
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm just mimicking my past life. There was an iron ore where we grew into a three mine, you know, fourth largest iron ore producer in the world over 8 years. And it's very, very similar thematics and just following the same playbook here. And we have a region of nine mines and we'll be developing several of those over the next few years into a very large global sulfate of potash SOP player.
Marvelous stuff. Okay. Three T's or three reasons. If someone's listening right now, likes the sound of the progress you're making, Tony, but not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add Salt Lake Potash to their watch list, please.
You got it. The three T's. The first is thematics, Justin. So, you know, believing in those macro, you know, thematics that support, you know, the demand of fertilizer, growing populations, depleting arable land, you know, shifting wealth patterns in society, which changes diets. People want more in that diet, you know, of berries and citrus and nuts and avocados and flowers, all the things that demand SOP, sulfate of potash. So it's got some fantastic thematic tailwinds that really, really attract me and the team to this project. So that's the first T, thematics. The second T is technical. You know, this is a high grade in terms of a mine grade scenario. This first lake we're developing is the highest. High grade drives less capex. So that's the first in the technical space. Financials I've talked about. You know, the financial modelling around this first project is very, very strong. And also the infrastructure. So if people, you know, Google map Wiluna in Western Australia, that's where this Lake Way is, just south of Wiluna. We have existing infrastructure in a highway, a goldfields highway, sitting on the western edge of our lake, 500 metres from our process plant where it's been constructed now. We have the goldfields gas line just on the eastern edge of the lake. We're tapping into that for gas, for power supply. And then just on the northern edge of the lake is the Wiluna town airstrip, where we land our planes and 12-minute drive straight to the work site. So smothered in existing infrastructure that's really supporting a fast pathway project that we're enjoying now. So that's the second T, technicals. And the third T is team. I'm very, very proud to talk about the team, you know, loud and proud here that I've amassed thousands and thousands of years of experience in construction and operations. And a lot have come with me and followed me from my past life. So it really is an incredible A-grade team that have built, constructed, commissioned and operated many sites in many commodities before, and a lot of them with me. So, you know, capability that's here for the market cap of our size is very impressive. And then coupling onto that is our design construct contract that we've just formally signed up, GR Engineering Services, a world-renowned West Australian-based sort of mid-cap design construct company. They're the sort of guys that have got skin off the knuckles and dirt under the nails, and they've built, you know, many, many plants in Western Australia over several decades, and they've also built plants all around the world. So they're in bed with us as well. It's a fantastic team. So that's the third T. Our three are the thematics, the technical, and the team.
Marvellous stuff. Tony, good to chat to you. You're the fourth T, Tony, and good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much, Tony.
Thanks for the opportunity, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Wayne.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Rickett, CEO of Asarion VRS. Just took it there. Neil, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin. Been a while since we've spoken.
Yeah, it's been a while, yes. And, if anything's changed, give us a summary. For people tuning in now, I know a lot of people who have been locked down and now start to become investors or traders, so there's a lot more listening going to podcasts. But if no one's heard you on before, Neil, or don't know Asarion, just give us a brief summary as to what you're all about, please.
Okay, so we started in 2011, and we've been looking at the exploitation of materials out of UK universities. More recently, that's been around a total focus around graphene and how we can get graphene commercialized. And both of these announcements today relate to graphene.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's start with the first one. Is a 5 million Innovate UK loan agreement. And take us through this. And it's one of the biggest they've done, isn't it?
This is the biggest they've done, and it's a testament to the support that we're getting from UK government. I think they've done an outstanding job during quite difficult times. But it's about focusing on some of these really key projects for the country and how we can deploy those and how the government can help us. And in this particular case, this is through Innovate UK that we have a very good relationship with, and they've supported us all the way through our journey. But as you say, it's the first time they've done anything like this, and it's a nice loan for the company. It means that our loan repayments commence in 45 months after we've started drawing down the money, which is going to come in eight tranches. And then we pay, it'll be paid over the 36 months after that. So for the company, it enables us. It's non-dilutive for the shareholders. It's a real good indication of the government's commitment to this new technology. You know, they've invested heavily in the Graphene Engineering Innovation Centre and the National Graphene Institute. And this is an extension of that. This is about giving us the credibility to now go after these bigger opportunities and to give us access to capital in a very difficult market. You know, we're all aware of exactly what's happened in the market, and if we want to expand quickly and we want access to, say, £5 million, then that would be expensive in the current market. And this is a way of being able to think creatively with the support of the UK government in order to reap the benefits of all of the investment that they've made in the north.
Yeah. And it says hopefully this has enable you to significantly increase your manufacture of quality assured graphene. So where are you with that at the moment? How much can you commercially produce, or is that a bit sensitive?
No. So we've always said that our capacity at the moment through our graphene system, which creates Nanine, and our other product HP, has a total capacity, if you ran it flat out, 24 hours a day, of about 3 tons. And this is a loan to enable us to be able to expand that to meet the demands of future customers, and have the balance sheet that enables us to have some significant conversations with those potential customers.
Never
any guarantees, as everyone knows, but what the company's been able to do here is to build on the £6 million placing that we did with Lanstead and the sharing agreement that we RNS'd a while ago, and to add this £5 million loan on top of that.
Yeah, well, you said there, you're going to increase the potential supply here. What is demand like? What kind of interest you're getting from big industry at the moment for your product?
So this is graphene is still in the early days. there are products out there, but they may not necessarily contain what we would call graphene, and or at least what's defined by the ISO standards as graphene. Yeah. What we're seeing now is a lot of customers that have that have used these products in the past have been disappointed with the performance that they've got, and they're now looking for reliable, repeatable supply chain, you know, kind of industrial processes to get the materials that they need. So I think even during COVID, the team has been really, really busy. You know, this is another sign that business has been continuing. You know, we've had these conversations with the UK government, but we've also been talking to our commercial partners, and you know, that resulted in the RNS, where we're developing technology with Rolls-Royce, and also with the Horizon 2020 program, where we're working with Airbus on, you know, technology which will be for the future.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned that, you know, you've had issues with, you know, big industry maybe trying out making the first foray into the world of graphene, and maybe been scammed in some way, or not using high quality graphene, and they found the old saying, buy cheap, buy twice. Is that a problem at the moment? You know, that people are just seeing graphene as graphene rather than sort of looking at the quality of it.
I think it was described by someone I was talking to yesterday as there's an awful lot of black powder around, but there's very little material which can be quality assured. That's what this grant, or what this loan actually enables us to do. Yeah. So this loan is all about getting our production quantities and the manufacturing process of this quality assured graphene manufacturing up to the standard that's required by UK and the export of that into lots of countries, including China.
Okay, cool. Okay, and also, and today you did a sort of a corporate update, and in specifically about China. And what's happened here? Because it looks like you've stopped the JV happening there. Is that the case or not?
So we had a backstop in the original. In the original contract, and we've decided to activate that. It takes away any timing issues around China. It enables us a certain degree of flexibility, and so we've kind of, things have changed dramatically, not only in the UK but in China and places like Hong Kong over the last kind of 6 months with the effects of COVID. Beijing currently is locked down, and that makes it very, very difficult to do some of the practical things that you need to do in these negotiations. So what we've done here is we've activated the backstop. We've taken control back of the of our wholly owned foreign entity, which is now called Beijing Fusarium Technologies. And then we'll move forward with a slightly different plan for China, but involving, obviously, we also announced the appointment of Matt Walker. More recently, we've appointed James Stewart as our non-exec chairman. Both of these are highly involved in China. And so, you know, China's going to be important for us, but we may be doing it in a slightly different way, that's all.
Yeah. So you still have interest in China, you're saying? I mean, it's still potential there, maybe not this company, with other companies that are expressing interest?
I think it's just the nature in which we're going to be working moving forward. You know, we've always said that, you know, one of the difficult aspects with having a partner in China is control, and we always want 100% control. We've got some very... You know, our business is all about IP, and yeah. So we have to protect that IP come what may. And there's no substitute for having 100% control of that IP. And so in this particular case, you know, things have changed in China over the last kind of 6 months in terms of the types of companies that we're getting interest from. And that's what we'll be doing. We'll obviously be doing that with the support of the UK government now as well, because, you know, they're effectively a stakeholder in what happens. We've had some very interesting conversations getting Matt Walker to change from being involved in the government to being involved in the commercial business. And I'm sorry that took a while, but getting high-profile, high-ranking civil servants out of the government when they've had security roles is a challenging process in itself. But now Matt's on board, and Matt will be looking after our international strategy, which includes China, but also our government relationships and building on the great work that this loan agreement has laid the foundations for.
Yeah. And has government, you know, sort of alerted you to say just the, be careful with dealing with China? We know there's IP issues there. Has that made you more wary of them?
I think it's fair to say that we've had some interesting conversations from about November last year. And, you know, this is the fruition of that, you know, and we continue to work with the UK government to really exploit this thing that they've invested very, very heavily in, you know, which is this graphene technology. And so we're working kind of hand in hand with the government and taking all the advice we can. We're still a relatively small company, and there's nothing better than having the support of a government behind you to make sure that you don't make any mistakes and that you are doing, you know, everything you can to make the best of what is a great opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. And what's your thoughts now still? I mean, you know, are you still bullish and optimistic as ever about the graphene market?
Yeah, well, I don't think we would have activated the backstop arrangement if we weren't absolutely convinced that it was the right thing to do. And, you know, graphene, I actually think that graphene has matured significantly in the last 12 months around how graphene will be used in an awful lot of applications that we take for granted on a day-to-day basis. Mm. You know, it's the more we learn, you have to understand there's no, you know, there's the stuff we're learning on a day-to-day basis is unbelievable. This is like entering into a new science. Mm. So although some of the kind of more well-known things are in the public domain, kind of some of the benefits we're only just starting to discover now, and that can be everything from antiviral or antibacterial or flame retardancy or all sorts of things that we never considered to be part of the graphene influence, but are now through independent testing being borne out.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, Neil, if someone is listening right now, I'd like to sound of what you're doing here, graphene, but it's not yet following that story, as always. Three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add Vasari into their watch list, please.
Okay, so the first thing is that we have relationships with the University of Manchester, University of Cambridge, and that puts us in the place to be able to exploit this graphene technology in the UK. The second thing is the quality of the collaborations that we're working with, as I mentioned, Rolls-Royce and Airbus more recently, means that we are dealing with very large blue-chip companies worldwide. And the final thing is that I'm still one of the major shareholders in the business, second shareholder and largest individual shareholder. And therefore, my aims and ambitions are all aligned to those of the long-term holders.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Good to chat to you, Neil, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Yeah, very well. Thanks. Very well. Markets seem to be behaving themselves, albeit that we're kind of stuck in a sort of a tight range, really, aren't we? They sort of go up a bit and down a bit. I don't know, we can't really call it the pre-summer malaise because, unfortunately, there's too much stuff, important stuff, going to be going on this summer. I think maybe it's just the pause before the storm.
Yeah, well, do you know what? People, it's funny you say that. People never factor in the sideways move of a market. It's like people always assume it's going to go up, or it's going to crash down, it's going to be extreme in some way. But in actual fact, what we got here, we know a lot of the stuff we know is going to be bad. How much of that is priced in, we don't know. But then you've got like the figures from America, jobless figures coming out, almost gaining massively in June. And so, you know, economies are opening back up. So we know it's bad, but it's going to get less bad. So where does that leave the markets? And yet we've got stimulus, you know, it could be happening as well. So we may not ever have, it'll be volatile, but we may not even retest the lows again. So, you know, it's hard to say, isn't it? Every now and again, we may hear people say, well, the valuations are quite high for certain companies, considering they're not really fully open. So they may drop. But again, I don't think we're going to have that all market sell-off we've had, like we had in March. Do you?
No, I don't think so. And, you know, I remain highly invested. I've sort of identified a number of companies I like the prospects for. I think they're interesting. And to me, when I look across different asset classes, you know, you've got to be doing something with your money. You know, that may be sitting on a lot of cash in the bank, but you're not getting paid to wait there. That's the thing. So my view is the equity market is the place to be. What you've got to be, though, is prudent and cautious and sort of opportunistic with your allocations. You know, for me, it comes back down to, am I excited being a stock picker for 2020, looking forward in the 2020s generally? Absolutely. And that can only be a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's any worry out there, but when you delve into it a bit further, it's not really as big a worry as we thought. I mean, if you look at America, infections are up at the highest level ever. But you have to realise that they are testing a lot more. Tests are getting better. More people are being tested from all different age groups, and yet the death count is very low still. So we are now seeing that the people who can be affected by this are probably shielding. The people who you know, just not being affected by it, getting tested. Yeah, I've got it. Oh, I didn't know I had it, really. So it's not as big a deal. I mean, I think we can sort of realise we can open up the economy as long as we're careful, because the majority of people working in the economy aren't the people being affected, you know? So, yeah. You know, economically, I think it'll get better, the market. It'll get better. We're in a bad place, but it'll get better, I think, you know?
Yes, no, I would broadly agree with that. I think we've got a playbook, if you like, coming from China, and now we're sort of seeing it in Western Europe, obviously including the UK within that. You know, clearly there are challenges, we all see that, but a lot of that is factored in the sense that the average fund manager is cautious, the average sentiment survey is highly muted. We see all the challenges, but we see the reaction too, and it's always how you respond that matters. The States does worry me in the sense that it's a huge economy. However, when you look at that market, I would make two observations. The first is that it has been highly driven by a variety of a very narrow section of technology and related sort of names. The average American stock has not perhaps performed as well as perhaps looking at the headline indices would suggest. And certainly that reflects perhaps more the reality on the ground in America, which isn't flawless. The other aspect is the average American investor, institutional or individual, just does not invest at the moment within opportunities in Asia or Europe. Their allocations there are still very low, and I think that's an opportunity at the margin for markets outside in the rest of the world to start to perhaps capture a bit more attention, which can only be good for the average UK stock or average Asian or European stock. So yeah, as always, it's complex. As you say, perhaps the real key is just being persistent and patient, because we do have these periods of time where just it isn't clear and things work through and take time. And it's only when you look back you realise that, oh my goodness, I actually did rather well in that company, but it just kind of ground it out over a period of time. It's not all, you know, violence and huge excitement as we saw in sort of earlier parts of this year.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, as time goes on, let's be honest, I think time's on our side, because there's good news from vaccines coming out, clinical trials, there's good news from antivirals coming out. So, like I said, now we're gearing up to fight the battle. Before we're knocked, you know, it's like almost taken by surprise by the vaccine. Now we're not. So, like I said, lots of things we can tackle the second wave. We know a lot more about the virus than we did beforehand. Okay, so let's look specifically at company news. What's out there, Chris?
Well, got to start with Associated British Foods, which sounds kind of a bit boring, doesn't it? And they still do have foods angles. I mean, Twinings Tea or Ovaltine or brands like that are still owned by ABF, and they've owned them for many, many years. But it's actually another part of their business which has captured all the attention recently, and that, of course, has been Primark. And whilst, you know, the Twinings and the Ovaltine and the British Sugar kind of crack on in a fairly sort of sluggish growth, but still broadly positive manner, Primark's been all over the place, because unbelievably, and I had to check this, I literally did check this on the website just to make sure my understanding was correct, because unsurprisingly, I'm not a big Primark shopper, you know, kind of naturally. They don't have an online presence. It's absolutely amazing in today's world that if you want to buy Primark stuff, you have to go to the physical stores. Now, this is clearly an error of a first degree. And whilst I'm sure Primark does have cheap clothing and, you know, certainly it's been popular, you look at the historic profitability growth, it's been huge. number of shops being open, etc., etc. But that's yesterday's world. You know, tomorrow's world is all about increasing e-commerce, increasing sort of online selection and choice. We can see all these trends happening already, and they've been given a massive boost by obviously everything that's happened this year. Now, Primark stores are reopening. That was the good news from today's numbers. However, you can see the impact. You know, if you look at the last quarter of data that they had, revenue was down 75%. And that was because during that period, you know, for a good period of time, the stores were closed just because people were locked down and not going to the high street. So it is getting better for them. They gave some profit updates for this year where they think that Primark will make about a third of what they made last year, which, you know, is it's nice that they're profitable. But for me, ABF, you know, it's sort of the Western family have kind of dominated the ABF sort of management and profile for a long time. Conservative players, and that's a good thing. They've got net cash on the balance sheet. They're prudent long-term thinkers, and you've seen that in the way they've handled the brands elsewhere and kind of, if you like, encouraged the growth of Primark over time. However, you know, not to have an online presence, I think, has been a serious own goal. And my view is they've got to put some serious money into developing that side of the business, because the trouble is that's where retail's going.
Yeah, I just think that you said there the management have a big hold on the stock and stuff, but for a long time everyone said, why didn't you spit it out? Primark is obviously a growing brand. They've almost missed that, yeah, that opportunity now, that window of, when it was really hot and almost everyone started copying the Primark model, you know, cheap and throwaway fashion, and almost they missed that window, and they've about 10 years now. But and if you look at the share price, it's grinding lower, and you think, well, you should just spun that out. And again, they haven't got online presence. They've missed an opportunity again, haven't they?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, hindsight's, you know, as always, hindsight asset management is the best performer out there. But apparently they had every single investment bank crawling over them over recent years. And you can see why. You're absolutely right, Justin. You know, the spin-out opportunities on a Primark was obvious. It's kind of distinct and very different from, you know, Twinings Tea or British Sugar or stuff like that. You can imagine internally it wouldn't have been a great hassle to have subdivided it. You know, it's not as if you're sharing manufacturing locations or anything. So it would have been a very easy deal. I think, though, they took the view that there was such a great growth opportunity, and there appears to be, you know, insatiable demand for such clothing, or at least good demand for such clothing. But that was yesterday's world. You know, the delivery mechanism has to evolve. It has to broaden. We can see through the growth of a Boohoo, even ASOS has had a few problems, but even the fact that sort of more legacy or historic brands, you know, the M&S's of this world are becoming sharper on the online front. I'm not sure that M&S and Primark particularly compete, but you get the point. You know, Next is still the gold standard here. Look how long ago Next moved to Next Directory, let alone Next Online. So, you know, that Primark has got to push into this direction. My feeling is they could still spin it off and it would still get a pretty sum. But the question is, and the valuation you would put on it is undoubtedly a lot lower, because people know they need to put money into developing the online arm. So I find ABF shares, I tried to do some numbers on it, and it is complex. It is a sum of the parts sort of play. And the shares have, you know, regained that 20 quid level, which, you know, is great. But the thing is that I just would be kind of watching them here. 20 quid kind of feels a sort of an important sort of resistance, support sort of level, and we kind of see where they go from here.
Cool. Okay, what's next, Chris?
Well, next one up is a share I own, for full disclosure, is DS Smith in corrugated packaging and sort of related products. You know, think about what your Amazon package typically comes in. That's corrugated board, and that's a big sort of, it's a solid growth area, because clearly the rise of e-commerce has meant the demand for corrugated board has been underpinned. And also you've got a lot more, because of sort of things like recycling and sustainability, you've got a lot of the fast-moving consumer goods companies, they're big users of corrugated board. That's about 70% of DS Smith's business nowadays. They've come out some numbers today. The shares have not taken it well, actually, which is surprising, given they've talked about being resilient. You know, the profits in the year up to the end of April were slightly up, and they've talked about a limited COVID-19 impact, which pacing through the numbers seems apparent. Clearly, conditions in this year, the year up to April 2021, are going to have a few new challenges. They, you know, as per many other companies, haven't given a profits upgrade or update, but clearly profits are going to be hurt. But my reading of it is not that bad. I mean, not just because of their customer base or the rise of e-commerce, but the fact that, you know, it's not particularly industrially centered anymore. It's much more consumer centered, and, you know, some of the things that are involved with will give some underpinnings here. So I still like the shares. Very surprised to see them below £3 when I looked earlier today. And personally, I would be a buyer when I look at where I think the profits I'll make, the fact that the debt's coming down, cash flow's been good. I think this is something which is a winner, and I think is good value today. So I certainly would. I am a holder. I am, in the fullness of time, certainly going to be buying more shares in this one.
Marvellous stuff, cool. And anything else there? What's any other news?
Well, final one's got to be pubs, and obviously we're coming up to the big reopening, at least in England, of pubs on Saturday this upcoming weekend. Mitchells & Butler, big pubs operator, came up with their half year numbers. Obviously, they are slightly historic, and clearly and unsurprisingly reflect the fact that for certainly the last few months of the accounting period, pubs were closed, and that helped push the company into a loss. Obviously, they furloughed most of their staff and related. What do we think? I mean, it's a difficult one, because clearly you're having to take a punt on where profitability might get back to, what trading might be like over the rest of the summer and obviously into the autumn. And that's obviously tough to countenance and work out. I think two observations on this one. The first is, they have the £2 billion of debt, which is, you know, a decent whack, certainly for a company with a market cap of less than £1 billion. They do have £4 billion of assets, and those assets are, unsurprisingly, mostly obviously the pubs that they operate. And I think that's the big debate for investors, just how much are those assets worth? They announced a £500 million write down of value based on how they sort of saw the business and value of the assets they had. So that asset value is under a bit of pressure for all the reasons that we can see, you know, trading being tough and pubs being closed at the moment and stuff like that. Quite what you pay for it, that's a very good debate today. I when I look at the shares, they've doubled pretty much from the lows of the dog days of March this year. So, you know, if you were a risk in embracing investor at the right time, you've done very well on this one. But, you know, they're still substantially down year to date, and that's all to do with that amount of debt. So it's a debt versus assets play. If you're feeling kind of lucky and risk embracing, then maybe you see an opportunity in this one. Personally, I'm going to be waiting for to see how the pubs reopen, how sustainable it is, what trading is like, what the next set of numbers are like. There's just too much debt here for me to get excited, even though it is in theory asset backed. The trouble is, as we've seen from shopping centres and other things, property values are not what they were, and you can't use that as a basis for getting excited or buying shares today, I'd say.
Yeah. No, do you know what? I've got to say, we are going out for a meal and a drink on Saturday because we've got a friend who owns a nice little sort of a pub restaurant, and fair play, they've been trying their hardest on Facebook and trying to deliver and all that stuff. But I'm just wondering if that's what's going to happen. There's going to be a trend of people just going out for the first time to support local business and all that stuff, and then whether that'll taper off. And of course, when you have debt like that, like you say, you know, you've got to be able to sort of pay the interest on it. And if you can't, there's big problems. And when you come to hard times, you've always got to look at the company's debt, haven't you? Because that's what takes companies under, you know.
that's debt is always the biggest killer of equity value. And sure, you know, there are always a few ways you can get out of debt. You can generate growth, you can have earnings, and obviously that matters. Cash flow hugely matters as well, clearly, within that. And clearly, Mitchells and Butler have been prudent. They've been tapping liquidity schemes, and they've had, you know, banking covenant waivers and stuff like that. But ultimately, you've still got that fundamental problem. But it's interlinked with assets. And, you know, those 4 billion of assets, 2 billion of debt, and a billion thick end of equity value, you know, you've got to make your judgment based on those metrics. At this moment in time, I think that is still insufficiently attractive for me to get involved. You know, clearly those that had a punt at a quid a share have done very well. But here now, thinking about it, nearly £2 a share, I would just wait and see how things pan out.
Yeah, well, let's be honest. Most people who were panicking, and some of the normal people, when the market didn't seem to want to stop falling, most people weren't buying. And anyone who bought at those levels on any stock would have done well now, even gold. Because everyone thought, this is not a stop. So fair play. If you had the guts, the balls, or you didn't care to buy at those levels, fair play, done well. But even that, if you look at that fall, the fastest in history, pretty much, you know, you maybe started scaling in halfway into that fall. It still went even further down, double that, and so yeah. I don't think anyone really gets the bottom, did they?
No, timing is everything, and absolutely. The only way you can really work it, because you don't, people, again, hindsight asset management is always the best performer. People think it's easy to kind of put all the chips in right at the bottom. In fact, almost nobody does that. And actually what you tend to do, and this is true institutionally or personally, is that you tend to sort of put money in kind of slowly. So I think it's perfectly reasonable, and this is what I did. You know, I certainly didn't capture the bottom. I put some money in, at around the bottom, but I also put money in kind of a few percent above the bottom and a few more percent above the bottom, etc. I kind of laddered my money in during February, March and April. So, you know, some of that caught the bottom, some of that didn't, but it expressed that broad view that I felt opportunities were rising. And that's all you can do. You know, find some good ideas, things that you like, sensibly financed, have an appropriate asset allocation given your personal profile and risk preferences and everything else, and go from there. Keep monitoring it. Keep your fingers crossed. Naturally, need a little bit of luck in this world, but keep monitoring, keep thinking, and hopefully it works out in the end.
Yeah, luck favors the brave. Marvelous stuff, Chris. Thanks for that, and we'll speak to you next week.
Sounds good to see you then.
Okay, time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five on the market. Of course, Clive was on the podcast. Up 7% to 85 pence. At 4, Rockfire Resources, up 9.3% to 1.175. At 3, GFIN, ticker there, of course. You can check out my video on that. Just search Justin Waite, GFINITY. And you'll find that somewhere on YouTube. It's up 1.3% to 1.925. At 2, Amigo Holdings, AMGO. That's a hammering of late, but it's up today, 7.1%, 5.5 pence. People obviously trading that. And at 1, Catalyst Innovations, big riser recently. And Alan Green, fair play, he's mentioned those in the podcast several times. That's CT, as in drinking tea, ticker, CTEA, ticker, up 28% to 7.4 pence. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At 5, Live Company Group, Marwell Zoo opening an investor Q&A. At 4, Ariana Resources, commitment by Ozalatin Holdings. At 3, I knew it was going to be Armadale Capital or Metal Tiger, never put their names in our RNS. It's Mining License, where is it? Mining License, application submitted. At 2, Iron Ridge Resources, historical results, Zalano, Gold, Cote d'Ivoire. And at 1, Omega Diagnostics, approval for sale in India. That's the biggest rise, of course, on the COVID index today. 6.8% up, 43.5 pence. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.